Good morning, everybody. This thing seems to be working okay. Welcome to this Tuesday morning session on advanced infrastructure for Config Manager SP1. My name is Kent Agerlund, and as of actually yesterday, I was a Config Manager MVP. I'm not any longer, so now I have a new MVP status called Enterprise Client Management. So now we know everything about the cloud as well as Config Manager. Next to me, I have one of the foremost experts in the world on Config Manager, Brian. Brian, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Brian Mason from Wells Fargo. We manage about 365,000 resources there. I'd say about 5,000 of that is servers. The rest just all workstations. We've been managing all those clients with SMS and CM07, and now we're just moving into CM12. So if I come off as a big CM12 expert, can I give you real-world experience? I can give you lab experience, and I give you a lot of experience. I've been talking to other people, but I've only built my infrastructure, and I haven't migrated anybody onto it yet.
But then again, your lab is the size of an average Danish company, so that's
kind of
okay.
We have like 1,000 people in our big lab.
So that's okay.
So what are we going to talk about today? We're going to go into SQL a little bit, because what's ConfigMan without SQL? SQL is everything, and if you can set it up right and you can optimize it, you're going to be happier. You're going to get faster reporting. You're going to get better numbers. And we're going to show you how to do that by offloading roles and such like that. Then we're going to go into some workgroup and force things that have changed since CML7 that you might want to be aware of.
So when we developed this the slide deck here in this session, we kind of based it on some of the things that we have seen in especially the implementations that I've done and the stuff that we have seen in the forums for the last year. There's a lot of misunderstandings on how we actually configure Config Manager when we want to do load balancing and fault tolerance and so on. So that's one of the key takeaways of the sessions in here.
SQL edition. There's two of them, standard and enterprise. Almost everybody can get by with just enterprise or standard. Enterprise is kind of expensive. It's nice to run, and if you're a big, huge shop and you can afford it, that's cool. But everybody should be able to run SQL Standard Edition for any kind of system center role you want to do. That means WSUS. You don't have to use the Windows internal database. You can use SQL Standard if you want to, and actually I recommend it. But for Scorch and SCOM and any other that standard is included, and I don't see most people ever having a need for enterprise.
So what would be a valid reason for me to actually spend that extra money and go enterprise? I mean, I have this brand new server, 64 cores and everything, and I'm just happy.
Well, if you use standard, you'd only be using half of those cores, because standard is, that's where its limitation is.
So that's okay. So that's just a waste of my money. The next thing we see and hear a lot is the SQL Server version. How do we actually figure out which one we should use? And the answer to that one is fairly easy. For the SQL Server version and the service pack, always look at what Microsoft has announced, what they support. For the CU, don't wait for an official support statement, because often those will not come. So if there is a new CU3 release, a CU4, what you really should do is you should read through the documentation. Do you actually need that CU? And then do a lot of testing in your environment, but don't wait for a statement, because that won't come.
When it comes to SQL on-box or off-box, there's a lot of opinions on that, and most of this front row is MVPs, and we're almost all 100% in agreement. We really kind of hate SQL off-box if we can avoid that problem. I notice there's SPN issues, there's setup issues that people just run into over and over. It's an extra box that you've got to manage, and it's an extra box that could go down. So now I have a primary site, and then I took SQL and I put it off box. That SQL box could die, and I've doubled the chance of a failure now in my environment because I offloaded SQL. Oh, but now I can cluster it. Okay, now I've just built it even more complex because now I have to support a cluster. And yet the primary can still go down, and I'm still where I was when I started. So I'm kind of a SQL on box kind of guy.
So how about those enterprise environments where we have like 45,000 clients or 65,000 clients? Are we going to do SQL on box as well? Or?
I hear that too. A lot of companies think that just because they're bigger, they have a lot, that they should offload it. And big isn't it. IOPS is really your key. But I can give you real world experiences. In CMO 7, we have a primary that got up to 155,000 clients on it.
Which, by the way, is not supported.
It's not supported. We didn't even intend it for it to go that high. But it did work. SQL's on box. It's only 32 gig box. And the reason why it still survived the day was it had great disk I.O. And that's really kind of the key to helping performance. It's not SQL offloading. It's disk and IOPS.
So hopefully that's one of the key messages of this session here. Once you walk out, you realize that you don't need a CAS, and you will at least consider having SQL on box. Another common question is, what is the estimated database size? So if we have like 12,500 clients, how should we actually size our disks? And there is no correct answer to that, because I've seen the average client size being between, 20 megabytes, and all the way, I think you had, at one point, you had an average client size on, what was it, 1 megabyte?
Yeah, one.
Yeah, which is, by the way, that's not standard. I mean, you have Sherry on board, and she knows how to trim everything. Nobody should really enable all the hardware classes or asset intelligence classes or anything like that.
Sherry will let you say, I'll let you inventory monitors or something weird, that you video cards or something, but I'm going to say you got 3 months and then I'm turning it off. And if you need it again, you can come back to me and we'll renegotiate. But she keeps those things turned off. And I think when we get into CM12, because we can use custom settings, I can even narrow it and get back to that yeah. one meg size.
That's a pretty good point. But at least if you need to enable stuff, and it's a request from one in your organization, make sure that it's a limited service that you're offering, because they don't need that hardware inventory in the database for the next 3 or 4 years. So that's a pretty good
Just
point.
Just mark it in OneNote or something. You could put an expiration on there and keep a list of these one-offs and who's the guy who asked for that, and ask him if he still needs it or is looking at it.
So some of the other SQL considerations, and this is extremely important. It's very easy for you to set it up, and it has a huge impact on your environment. First of all, when you start the install, you will get a warning saying, hey, you need to limit the memory. The thing is, how much memory do you actually need, and how should you limit it? My rule of thumb is I will reserve 2 gigabytes for the operating system. I'll reserve 2 or 4 gigabytes for a config manager, and then I will just give the rest to SQL. Because SQL will need it, and SQL will take it. The key thing in here is to limit it. Otherwise, SQL will take everything. Then a question about the standard database. How is it when we install Config Manager? It will install how many database files?
Just one.
So it actually, when you install Config Manager, it will by default install a database with just a single file. The initial size for that will be 5 gigabytes. Well, that's really not the size of your database in half a year from now. So what you will see, if you don't do anything about that, it will just expand as you go along. And that's actually quite costs a lot on your performance. So you want to make sure that you calculate what your database will look like in, like, let's say, 12 months ahead or maybe 24 months ahead, and then pre-create the database. Can we actually do that? Can we pre-create the database?
I've only pre-created my databases. So I'll set up SQL first, set up all my database files, put them exactly on the drives I want to put them on. And when all that's configured and up and running, looks pretty, then I'll go and start my CM install.
So in order for you to have control, and that's really what it's all about, you taking control, don't let SQL take control or Config Manager take control. Figure out how many files you need. A rule of thumb would be 1 database file per core. Make sure that you have planned for your TimDB. We have seen some weird issues with TimDB just freaking out, and yeah, not pretty. We will kind of cover that a little later. Make sure that you at least cap your log files. Not that long ago, we got a call from a customer saying, hey, we have an issue with our reporting server. The log file is now 150 gigabytes. I was like, wow. It's not meant to be 150 gigabytes, especially not if you're just a 1,000 client environment. So that's a pretty common issue. Make sure that you cap your log files so you know that you will never ever run out of disk space, because what will actually happen if I run out of disk space on my SQL?
If that transaction log can't write, SQL just stops, and restarting SQL doesn't help. So I think it's a pretty ugly process. Half of you would probably just go off to your SQL admins and say, help me, what can I do to get out of this, and put it in single user mode and drop that entire table, lose all that data, put it back, start it again, and it's ugly. So just save yourself and put that cap on that transaction log so it can't grow beyond the size of the disk that you put it on.
And also do that for the other databases that you're using, because Config Manager will control, it will actually put the recovery mode on the CM database into simple, but it won't do that for your reporting point or reporting services point database. So you need to be in control yourself.
So this slide is just really here to let you see, to think about laying out those disks, laying out the files, and trying to get the best I/O you can. We hear a lot of people ask, should I virtualize or not? At least they were asking that a couple years ago, and now a lot of people already have. But the key on this one, it's not virtual or not, it's all IOPS. So that disk layout there is something, that's an old disk layout from when we first designed how we were going to put our files out in CM07 on local disks. And I'll give you 1 second just to ponder something probably pretty important that I'd missed on laying out that set of files that I want on my CM disks. Anybody knows, I didn't think about backup? It's kind of important. You want to be able to back it up. So these things are split up for RAID. They're all on RAID 10. They're split up by controllers. Half of the CM files will go out to one controller and its disks. The other half will go out to another one. It's all about I/O. Backup you don't really care about, probably content library you don't care about for performance, but the rest of these things, the log files in CM are pretty important if you can split them up. There's lots of tricks you can do to even increase performance. Beyond that, if you can afford SSD, the tempDB is awesome if you can put that on SSD. And then the left pane here, I'm not going to read it to you, but the idea is if you can't afford that many disks and you want to consolidate it, bring it down, there's ways to merge these things together optimally. And the last one is just know your SAN team. I've heard so many stories of people saying, my SAN sucks or my SAN rocks, and you're not going to know what you get unless you really know the SAN team and you can talk to them. In fact, even then, I'm sorry, but I pick on another MVP. Greg's been having trouble with his SAN, and he thought he was getting the best, fastest thing he could, and it turns out he didn't. And then just last night, you don't even know this, just last night, number two, John Nelson, who works on our team, emailed me saying, our SAN that we thought we were going to get is a little slower than promised. So know your SAN team if you're going to go to SAN. Cross your fingers.
So with that, let's just go into the first quick demo here. Oops. Here you go. So as I said, it's all about kind of taking control. Guessing is good, but knowing is kind of better. So what you need to do is first and foremost figure out what is the size, the estimated size of your database. And this won't be a true number, but it's a pretty good guess. The majority of you in the room here works for an organization below 50,000 users. I know that because I've seen the stats for the session here. So if I wanted to do estimate that, so what would my the number of files and the memory and stuff like that look like in a 45K environment? I have this Excel spreadsheet, and it's it's available for download. We'll also make it available when we do a blog post on this one here. And we'll basically just say, okay, 45,000 clients. I have an estimated database size of 5. I will add in 4 processors and 16 cores, and the memory I have is 24 gigabytes. When I show this to a customer, they will always get back to me and say, okay, can we do with 16? And I will say, yes, sure, we can do that for a starting point, because this is what I estimate a year from now, and we won't do like a big bang day one. So I have the estimated size of the database. I have the number of files here, the estimated size per file, and the auto growth. So by default, I will make sure that it doesn't really have to expand as we go along. And the thing about this is that I actually need 230 gigabytes from the beginning. And some backup guys might say that it's really not a good idea to taking a backup of a lot of, it's actually just empty stuff, right?
Empty files mostly. At that rate, there's no data in them, but you're still going to be backing up a file that size.
So what we would do, or actually if we just keep on talking about the backup, that backup size of 250 gigabyte or how much it is, that's actually only if I do backup through Config Manager. Because if I do not do my backup in Config Manager, and I don't, because I don't need it in CM12, you can do with a SQL backup, it will actually compress the files. And then we're not talking about 250 gigabytes, but we're talking about something less. So it's okay to do this, and just make sure that you have your backup job in SQL. Next, what we would do is, on the wrong box there. The next thing we would do is we would actually create the database. So we have already done that, otherwise we wouldn't have Config Manager up and running. If I look at my database here, a few things to know about is I have already created the files. One thing that I have not done, though, is I have not kept my transaction log. So this is what it looks like. This is the default size, and it's actually it's pretty big. The disk that I have for this one here would never ever be able to fit half of what I have in here. So as Brian said, if I run out of disk space, I will way before I hit the limit in here, then SQL is not working. Config Manager is not working. People in your company are freaking out. And it actually takes you a little time, trust me, before you realize what the error is. Because you will go into all the Config Manager log files, I have a look in there, and there are just like something 450 or 500 log files that you will have to go through. And then it turns out it's just your transaction log. So make sure you cap this one here. Don't keep it unlimited. And I would definitely cap it to the size that I had in the Excel spreadsheet. Once I've done that, I would also go in and have a look at some of the other databases. So for instance, my report server. I don't know how many of you attended the MVP expert session yesterday, but in here, you would have noticed that the recovery model by default is full, so I want to configure this to simple. We don't really need a full recovery model. And again, I would go in on my files in here and make sure that I cap the maximum size. So don't keep it on the default values. It's really, really a bad idea. Let's just go back here. So one of the questions we get all the time in the forums is, okay, I need to design my site for maximum uptime. What should I do? The first thing I hear is, okay, I really need to have multiple sites. Because in all my wisdom, I know if my primary site goes down, automatically my 45,000 clients will just reassign to the next primary site that I have. That won't happen. It will not happen. And the traffic involved, if it actually did happen, that would be immense. I mean, we're going to talk about WSUS and multiple subs later on, and I can't even calculate the amount of traffic we would have to re-download on each client if I actually did a reassignment, especially for our software update points.
Yeah, it's just a disaster kind of. We actually only plan for that in a disaster recovery scenario. It's a last resort. You don't really ever want to design for it.
No, that's just having multiple sites, bad idea. I do know it will be required in some environments, but for the majority of you in here, you don't need to have multiple sites. And when we talk about multiple sites, we don't think about secondary sites, because we don't think that secondary sites are evil. They're actually needed sometimes. So another one?
Newest one is SQL 2012. If you're running it, is amazing. And if you've seen any demos or talk about SQL always on, you think, man, that would be awesome to have, especially for some of us who like to do a backup and recovery of our database for reporting, or maybe try to do some kind of thing to offload reporting services for us. SQL Always On sounds like a really cool solution to it, but it's not supported. And it might be one day, but if you go off on your own today, it's not supported.
And we know, I mean, as you can see, we're older than 20 years old, so we know that not supported is not the same as it's not working. but it, trust me, this can actually break the database, so I wouldn't go down that route. Another one is, okay, I really need to cluster my SQL. And I go like, why? Why do you want to cluster your SQL? For fault tolerance and stuff like that. Okay, so what are you going to do if your primary site is down? You're going to have 1,000 SQL boxes. It won't help you. So by installing SQL on a cluster, you'll actually just make your environment more complex than you really have to. So that's like a, to me, we can do it. Being a consultant, it's pretty good because I'll just add 3 days to the project. So I'm fine with that, but it will just be way too complex.
Another cool idea is to mirror SQL so that it's completely blind to CM. It won't even know that you're doing it. I've heard of people wanting to do that and people trying to do that.
And the thing is that the SQL mirroring actually works right up till the point where you do a Service Pack 1 upgrade. So this picture here is actually not taken from my demo environment. It's taken from a real production environment. Those of you who have done a Service Pack 1 upgrade, you know that you need to take a copy of the database. You will run a test upgrade against that copy of the database, and everything will work. Because when you do take the copy, that copy, you don't enable SQL mirroring. So you will not run into that error. Second, when you run the prerequisite checker that you need to run, it does not check for SQL mirroring. So if this is hosted on a SQL database controlled by the database administrators, and all you have is a copy and you have done all your testing on that copy, I mean, you just go in and start the Service Pack 1 upgrade, you have done everything, and then boom, this happens. You will not be able to roll back. So what you do instead is you test the restore feature, and it works. So just restore SQL, and then you go in and you run a CCM or Config Manager setup again. And I was actually up and running in less than 45 minutes. I wasn't happy about it. So the headaches that we're seeing is that for whatever reason, some of our customers really want to have a very complex environment. And we have written up here that we have a DBA battle, and that's because the database administrators, who we usually like, they're friendly people, but they want to take the Config Manager database. They want to treat it like it's one of their databases, and we really don't want to do that. We don't want to have mirroring always on. We don't want to use any of the other features. We don't want to have it on a cluster. We want to have it on the primary site server, and that's it.
But one of the things we used to fight with them on was stop backing up MySQL because I can't use your backup. That story has changed now. So. Yeah.
That actually costed me a bottle of red wine because I had to go back to the DBA team and say, okay, I'm sorry. You can monitor the backup now. Will you please do that? And he was just smiling. So talking of fault tolerance.
So this slide is just meant to really show if you're trying to get uptime, everything on that left pane is something that can help you achieve more uptime. You can have lots of distribution points. You can have lots of multiple MPs and SUPs and so on. Things on the right, you can only have one of, and the key on that one is the site server. There's only one. If it goes down, what are your options? If it goes down, does it mean there are some things that always will mean. It means that you can't get into console and create new deployments. It means that you can't get status back on what's going on out there for what you did set up. But if you have some of those other multiple instances running, some things can still run anyway. Anybody who got a policy at 1 in the afternoon to go run something at nighttime can still get to a distribution point and run it, and he will. So you got to think about offloading roles, keep them off that site server, because that thing's a single point of failure in any kind of design.
So we really want to protect the king, make sure that the primary site server is up and running at all times. So this is just the very same slide, but in here we added in a cloud-based distribution point. You can have multiple of those. If you do a Windows Intune connection, you can actually only have one of those.
So getting back to that idea of helping performance and uptime, they're two goals that you can have both of them. And the best way to do it is I make a rule at Wells is we just don't put IIS on a primary ever. We won't do it. And that means all those user-facing kind of roles are pushed off to other servers. My primary can concentrate on doing its own job instead of answering clients every second. Trying to get policy. So if we start offloading these roles to another server, you have a primary who's starting to get overworked and he's tired and you're thinking, well, maybe I'm going to take SQL off box. Don't do that. Instead, take that SQL, some of that SQL load away and put them on another box. Instead of all the SQL, just put these roles on another server. You could have one new server that's got a management point, a SUP, a DB, a DP, and that thing will answer the phone for all those clients. It'll take all that work. But it's only halfway there. You got to take one more step beyond that because the management point is it's just IIS and it's just answering the call. So it's going to say, yeah, I'll get you your policy, but it's like an operator who's still got to go back and he's got to hit the SQL on the primary and get that information. And if that primary goes down, I can't get you anything new. All I can, you know, I have no new information for you. He's down. But with the SQL replica, I can carve out a little piece of the major big database that's on a primary, just enough to answer that client's call and say, here's everything you need to know to do what the admin wants you to do today. It's a small database. It's like 3 gigs in size. And remember, SQL doesn't cost anything. So what we're going to do is install SQL on those management points, give them that little database. And so even if the primary goes down, the clients can still be told what to do. They can still follow the policy that you wanted them to do. So that one gives you the fault tolerance, but you're also getting the performance hit because none of those clients are hitting the primary asking over and over and over and over what you want them to do.
You actually surprised me yesterday because you said something clever. You said don't offload SQL, offload the SQL load, and that's really what this is all about. It's everybody goes, okay, we need to offload SQL. No, you need to offload the SQL load. So that was actually one sentence saying it all. So
I was clever once.
So now when we kind of know that, okay, we really want to have SQL unboxed, let's look at 4 different scenarios. And being from Scandinavia, we have a lot of customers with environments like this, below 2,000 clients. And you know what? In those environments, forget about what you read on TechNet. You can put everything on one box. And Brian, he will probably say later, you can actually run it from one of our laptops. So you can have all the roles, everything on that single primary site server.
I wanted to say that. He's got a laptop here, it's 32 gigs and it's dual SSD. Remember that primary that I was running in CMO7 was only 32 gigs. And I've got a lot of disks on it, but I don't think they're SSD speed, so I think this thing probably could run thousands of clients on its own. Anyway, on this slide, let's say we stage up and we're going to have a bigger client load. Some people think that they want to get some fault tolerance in there and they're going to go for a CAS. All that's going to buy you is replication delays and complexity. And I don't think it's the way to go. Instead, we're going to offload roles. Let's just put up a couple of servers underneath it and get those roles loaded onto them.
So for us, if you have a medium site and you have a let's call it an enterprise site, it's actually it's the same stuff we're installing on the primary site server. We're installing the non-user facing roles. So we will install SQL. We will install the primary site itself, of course. We could go ahead and install the endpoint protection site system role and some of the other non-user facing site system roles. But this is when we talk to customers that are like 20,000 and 65,000, a lot of those customers, they believe that they need a SQL enterprise. And they also think that they need maybe multiple sites because, after all, they have a data center here in the States and they also have a data center in Europe and they're really concerned about that. Maybe they have concerned about security and so on. And all of those concerns, we can absolutely have that in a single primary site. I mean, we don't need to set up multiple sites. Unless you're a real enterprise like you guys.
Right, and I'm being told there's only, Microsoft gave us a number that there's only like a couple hundred companies that they knew about that would really deserve a CAS, that they were big enough that they broke that 100,000 client barrier and that they'd need it. And when you do this kind of scenario, it's not wrong. There are scenarios, and you know, 365,000. I'd like to try to see if I could do it on one primary, but we won't.
So what actually happens if I have, let's say, I have 100,000 clients and one, only on a
it
primary?
It just stops. It breaks.
It stops. Yeah. It explodes.
No.
I haven't tested that, by the way. But the thing is that there are really no real hard-coded limits in Config Manager. There are a few when we talk about some software update stuff, but for supporting clients and stuff like that, that's like general recommendations because there's so much different hardware and it's all about IOPS, like Brian said. So that's one of the key things as well. If you have a minor data center in Europe, maybe with 6,000 clients. I mean, you could do with a secondary site there. It would work absolutely. You don't need to set up a new primary site down there at all. For some of the site system roles, when we talk about fault tolerance, the management point now we can have 10 of those. And then I've seen some designs where they say, okay, so we can have 10 management points. That's just great because I will place one. Here in Vegas, I will place one in Shanghai, I will place one in Berlin, all in the same primary site. But the thing is, a management point is not controlled by boundary groups like a distribution point. So I randomly select a management point. So if you do it like that, then your users in Germany, there is no way you can control that they will actually use the management point in Germany. So instead they will go here to Vegas, or they will go somewhere else, and you'll just, I mean, you have no control of that. So my recommendation is actually setting up the management points in your data center. You don't need 10. I mean, I don't know how many you're going to set up in your environment where you have more than 300,000 clients, but I would definitely recommend setting up two or three for fault tolerance, all depending on the size of your site. One thing to remember, though, is that a secondary site, you can only have one management point there.
But that is that one where you said these things are not site-aware, that the secondary is. So if you actually need that, That's what a secondary is for.
That's a good point. It works just like it did in CMO 7, so I will still go to that local management point. But you will just randomly select the management point from a list, and that list is generated every 25 hours or when you restart your service. So there are some preferences in there. So for instance, if you have an HTTPS management point, you will actually select that before you go and select a non-HTTPS management point. Also, if you're in a different forest and you have an MP there, you will actually select that first. So there is a little you can do in there.
And it keeps shuffling them up. If you look in the location services log and all MPs are equal, you can just watch it. You can say, I can watch mine and say it's going from MP1 to MP2 to MP3, and it just keeps flipping around randomly just to try to even out the load. Okay, so getting back to those replicas. I told you there's two important things that you know about them. They give you performance and fault tolerance. Performance means I'm taking the SQL load off of my primary and putting it onto the MP. Fault tolerance means my primary can go down, or one of the other MPs can go down, but my clients can still get policy. I told you already that you don't need a license for it. This is simple to set up. It's SQL transactional replication. You need to have the SQL agent enabled and set to auto. There are some downsides to this. If you're on RTM, you might want to go to SP1 first, because if you go and set this up, then you'll want to go to SP1. You got to tear it all down, upgrade to SP1, and put them back on. But as you'll see, I'll do a demo of doing this. It's not that hard, but if you haven't done it yet, get to SP1 first.
So one question here is, if I'm setting up SQL on my management point, do I need to do anything with the hardware requirements on that management point? Because now I'm installing SQL. Do I need additional volumes or anything like that? You mentioned the 3 gigabyte database size.
Yeah, so that's pretty small, right? So you pick the lowest end VM. I mean, an MP is nothing besides IIS. Okay, now we're going to pollute it with SQL. But this isn't heavy SQL. It's just a small 3 gig database. If you can have enough memory, so you can give like 3 gigs of memory to SQL, maybe one more for the OS, that might be cutting it slim. But if you have an 8 gig box, then definitely it would work. That means that entire database is just going to sit up in memory, and I don't care about disk I/O anymore. So you can put it on the lowest end VM, and I don't really care. We just need some memory to make this thing work.
Okay, so we actually don't have to plan for that. We don't have to buy any additional hardware, add any additional memory, anything like that. That's pretty cool. It's demo time.
So if I'm slow and weird with this, it's because we have this bizarre keyboard that's non-US, because the Danes have to be weird like that. So CMO2 is his primary server. CMO3 is an MP that he has out there. This thing, I think, already has replication on. So when you install SQL, if you don't see this replication node, you can just go back to your SQL install, click next, 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 and add a feature. And when you get to the little checkbox for replication, check that, finish up, finish install. Nothing happens. You don't blow up your database. You're just going to get this node added. And this node is where we can actually see that he has a publication of that little database, the small 3 gig thing I was talking about. This is called Replication Monitor. This helps you know that replication's running fine. I'm looking at it. There's no latency. There's nothing new going on. You would see, if you create a collection or something, you might see this thing pop up and say something just got replicated down. And what it's doing is going down to the flip side of this. This guy has a subscription. He's subscribing to a publication on the primary. And he has his own database. The database I was talking about was this little guy here, PS1 REPL. So to do all this, Kent's got a great document. So I'm going to show you how to get through this quick, but he's got a step-by-step document that you can download. It's a Word document. You can do this on your own. And you can do every single step in this thing without even breaking anything, because I can have this replication going, but until I go into CM and go to my management point properties and say, use the local database, use this PS1 database, nothing really happens. So you can experiment around with this and get used to it and make sure it's running. When Replimon is telling you, I'm checked out and I'm replicating fine, then you can flip it over. So try it out in the lab first, but you're not going to break anything just by making this replication. So with that said, let me destroy it.
And by the way, I'm using the same machine in my next session. So when you say destroy it...
Goodbye. There. That subscription's dead. Let me delete the database. Just wipe it right off the earth. The right database, not your primary.
That would be fun.
And I'm actually even going to nuke all of replication. Just goodbye. Yes, I really want to blow it up. Part of the reason of showing you me blowing it up and then recreating it is if you run into issues when you're doing it, using replicas, I don't have any issues. I mean, I've been doing them forever, and they're just pretty stable. They're kind of set and forget things. Ignore that, because I think if I F5, it'll just go away anyway. Yeah, it's gone. No publication. Sometimes a quick solution is just to blow it away and start over. Usually you don't ever have to blow away the replica up here. Usually you just have to create a new subscription at the bottom. If something happened the MP was down for so long that the subscription expired, you're just going to have to delete it and create a new one. But I'm blowing the whole thing away. And I'll put it back here in a second. But before I do that, let me show you some of the things that it's going to need. It's not, you don't work just in SQL. You got to create a share. It's called config man replica. And who has access is your replica boxes. They're in this local group. So they just have read and read, basically. Documentation is going to show you just how to set those things up in that group. Yeah. So he only needs CMO3 in here. That's one we're adding. So we're saying these guys are going to have access to a snapshot that gets created. That gives you a jump start to replication, and then after that point, you're going to just use transactional replication to keep up. So that's all blown away. I want to put replication back on, and to do that, if his alphabet works like ours does, connecting to the database, and I'm going to run this nice sprock that they gave us, which is beautiful, because in CML7 this is a lot more convoluted. But here we just run this little stored procedure, and it's going to put a publication on the primary for us. And voila, no errors.
You have no idea how happy I am about that.
We're not out of the woods yet. It also adds user guest. Some people have a problem with that. You can still go disable that. Every time you set up transactional replication, it likes to do that. So if you don't like that, if your SQL guys want to get rid of it, feel free. So going back to replication, it's back. We now have a replica. and I want to make a subscription to it. But before that, I do that, remember I nuked that database? I nuked it just so that I can show you how easy it is to create a database, so I'll make one. PS1 underscore.
Underscore? Got it. It's actually a US keyboard, by the way.
What are these weirdo keys? I always give the owner as SA. You could use, what else could you pick? Anti-authority system. Told you this is about a 3 gig database. Your mileage might vary depending on how many packages you have, but that's a pretty good ballpark, and it can grow if needed. I capped this to about 128. And that's just based on knowledge. I hate that auto growth of 1 meg. I'll probably just change that. I don't know what, 100, let it at least grow a little faster than a single meg at a time. Notice it's going to put those on the D drive. That's as good as a place to me as any, because we have enough memory that I don't really care where I put this. So there I created a database, but it's empty. So it has no tables, there's nothing in it, it's just a bare database. So we're going to populate it by making a subscription. I'm going to connect up to the publisher, who's on CMO2. I'm going to do a pull subscription. I'm going to use that new database that I just created. I want it to run under the SQL Server Agent account. That's why we have that on, and we set it to auto. If you disable it, you're in trouble. Keep this as run continuously. And I think the documentation, the official Microsoft documentation says every 5 minutes. I've seen subscriptions kind of fail sometimes with that and then expire. If you leave it at continuous, it just works. And if it works for me at 365,000 clients, it'll work for everybody. And I want a subscription to initialize immediately. I don't want to wait around. And we create it. Success. All right, now you can feel a little better. What that does is create a job down here. You get one job on here on your MP, and you're going to get a bunch of other jobs that run all this on your primary. And these are places where you can go and look for errors. If I look at the history of that job, one of the things you don't want to see are the little blue circles with an arrow on it saying retrying. If it's retrying down here in the bottom, it'll probably tell you what you did wrong. It'll give you some kind of indication of something's not working right. Sometimes a simple fix can be just restarting the SQL Server Agent. So the question is, did it work? How far are we? So remember that tool we showed at the beginning was Replication Monitor. It's running. It's inserting data for us. No latency, you have nice fast drives, good memory. It's only initializing, we're not quite done yet, but it's building. Once this gets done, it just runs. It doesn't matter if you reboot your MP, take it down for a few hours or something like that, bring it back up, it'll pick up where it left off and start over. And if it ever doesn't, if this thing's dead and you come up in that log and it's red, you can simply just delete that subscription and create it again. And by now we should actually have data in our replica. Right, so now we've given that MP information about boundaries and WSUS locations and all sorts of information it's going to need to be able to give any client the policy it needs. And now your SQL Server is happy because he doesn't have to listen to all these clients and give them all their policy. The MP's got that handled for them. It has enough info for them.
We actually saw some pretty interesting number at one time about CPU utilization. One of our friends, he had offloaded SQL to a SQL cluster. And I think in average, the CPU utilization was it very close to 80%. And what they did instead was they actually created MP replicas, and immediately that dropped down to 20%. So as you can see, don't offload SQL, offload the SQL load. It really means a lot.
And just to make sure you're good for your next session, I always go to mpcontrol.log. And I don't want to see 500s here saying I can't reach any database. I don't want to see that little error code 200, which is not an error. It just means I'm happy and I'm answering the phone for clients. So you should be good in the next session.
Then I'm happy. So it took Brian, well, it's not the first time you have done it. I've seen you do it at least once before. But it took him like 10 minutes to set up an MP replica. It took me like 5 minutes to configure the SQL files and cap the memory and all that. And to me, it's free, but it buys you a lot of performance. It's really important. You mentioned something about Service Pack 1, and you might want to set it up before Service Pack 1.
Right. If you do this at RTM, just what I just did there, you're going to have to right-click that, delete that publication, and then upgrade to SP1 and put it back on. So if SP1 is not in your immediate future, you can still go and run this today, or you can even practice with it. Nothing happens until you go back to the MP and tell it to use that replica, which, by the way, I didn't tell yours to go back and use its local. It's still set up, but you can see by that MP control log, it's still happy. Now, also new to SP1 is this client notification service. They added that on. They built that for SCEP so that you could quickly go tell these machines to go scan for a virus or go quarantine something. You wanted something to happen immediately. This kind of service is scary to people like me who have tons and tons of clients. I don't think we're going to enable it. But if you do, open up the port. And what we're doing here, kind of the main key takeaway to this is that you're just going to have a primary, create two certs, give that to the MPs. They'll create their own cert, send it back to the primary, and we're just exchanging certs, and we're doing it inside of SQL with commands like this. We're not going out to the MMC and going into public store or something like that. It's all done in here, so we're just going to export certs and import them, open up that port, enable the broker service. These are all done with SQL commands, and they're all laid out in that document that Kent made a couple months ago.
And failure to do this is, I mean, the only thing you will miss if you don't do this, that's the BGB functionality. And as Brian said, maybe you will use it, maybe you won't. You'll see some errors in the log files if you do not exchange the certs in here. So with that, another common thing or issue that I see is the distribution points. With Service Pack 1, we have a cloud-based distribution point. We have an on-premise distribution point, and the on-premise distribution point now comes in two flavors. You have the standard DP, and then you have the pool distribution points. We'll get back to them a little later. There is one thing about a primary site, and that is that it supports 250 distribution points. And the processing of that is actually taking place on the primary site server. So just picture a scenario where I have my main data center here in the States, and I have another data center in Europe. And I might have, let's say, 6,000 or 7,000 clients in Europe. I might have 3 distribution points. There is really no reason that all of those 3 distribution points should be serviced from the distribution or from the primary site server that we have in here. So what I will do instead is I will just set up one standard DP in Europe, and then I will set up pull distribution points. The pull distribution points will then make sure that they take the content from the local standard DP, and by doing that, I'm offloading a lot of processing from the primary site server. And it's all about protecting the primary site server, offload as much as we possibly can.
Okay, so benefits of cloud DP. I guess the big one is just that you can use it as a nice fallback. You know how we have in SP1, they allow us to fall back on SUPs to Microsoft. This is kind of like doing the same thing for DPs. If your DPs are down, maybe as a last resort, this is a good way to get data no matter what. So clients are always going to try to connect their DP by going to their preferred DP first, then fallback DP, and then after that, cloud DP. The big unknown on that one is just cost. Microsoft just recently, maybe 2 months ago, put out a blog post where you can try to get a ballpark to figure out what that cost is going to be. Cloud DPs are not free. When you pull data down, you're going to pay for it. How much? They start you off giving you an estimator. There's a blog out there, and I don't know if we have a link at the end of this or not, but we should put it in.
We'll make sure that when we post something about the session here, we'll absolutely add that link into it. So you're worried about the cost? I thought you worked for a bank. Some of the considerations we have around the distribution points is, if you picture an enterprise environment and you have, let's say, you have 200 distribution points worldwide, you're setting up new DPs in Asia. Those DPs, you really want to make sure that you don't start distributing content to those DPs. So you just pre-stage all the content, stuff like that. And then you realize that content is actually automatically sent to those DPs. And you go like, wow, that was not part of my design. I've seen some issues where people are going in and enabling the on-demand content push on packages. What that little check mark actually does is it completely takes away control from you, because if someone at that remote office is requesting an application and that application is not locally on the DP, it will just generate a DMD file, and that DMD file will tell the distribution manager on the primary site server to go process that 250 gigabyte package. Maybe it's not 250 gigabyte, but still you have no control. You still have, it still will use the WAN, the bandwidth that you have and so on, but you have no control of when the processing actually goes on. So you need to know about the fallback source location for content. You definitely need to know about that little check mark. And then you need to know about the pull distribution points. The pull distribution point is something you can install or you can enable on all DPs except the DP that you might have on your primary site server. Not that we would ever
do that. Don't do that.
Just don't do that. and you cannot enable it on your cloud-based distribution point. But besides that, you can actually enable it everywhere. You don't have to worry about much when it comes to security, except if you enable that pull DP in a remote forest. Because by default, we will be using the network access account to kind of pull the content and so on. And the network access account, if you set that up in a remote forest, well, you don't really have access to that. So in order to make that work, you need to install the config manager client on that remote pull DP. Then it will actually be able to work. And it works just fine. It does not honor any rate limits. So that's extremely important. You don't want to set up pull DPs in all your remote locations, because suddenly your bandwidth settings, even though they're there, it doesn't honor them. It will just go to its master, and you can have multiple masters. It will select one of them. You can control which one. And then we'll use bits to go ahead and download the content. So no throttling from Config Manager, no bandwidth control, anything like that.
We should have put a dancing ants font around that last one, because I've heard you say that one a lot, but it only just stuck out this time, that no rate limits. It's a pretty big, important point.
Absolutely. And the thing is, if you go in and have a look at the pull DP properties, you'll actually see all the rate limits.
Yeah, that would sucker me out. I'd be like, why isn't that listening to me? Yeah. Good to know. Okay, so out of all those kind of DPs, there's another one you can have, and that's peer-to-peer DPs. Using an alternate content provider, Microsoft's put this code in since I think the SMS 2003 days, where they're giving third-party people a chance to inject a little stop valve to say, wait, before you go off to that DP, do you have somebody else you can grab from? Ken can talk about Adaptiva. I'm a we're a 1E shop, and we've been using Nomad from 1E for years, and it helps me get from hundreds and hundreds of DPs that we used to have. We manage those 365,000 clients with about 50 servers now. It just works on an election process where I'm asking knackers there to grab this, yeah, pay attention, to grab this application, go install that. The first thing he's going to do is look around next to him, see if anybody else has it. If they do, no content's been ever pulled from the net. But if there is, he pulls it first. And anybody else around him who needs it will start getting it from him. And it just kind of fans out, and it's really silent and helps our network. It's a great alternative to putting out remote DPs.
We're kind of running out of
time.
Okay, go. So we much rather do a little demo. So I want to demo a few things, including a little extremely cool tool that will be available later. So first, let's go into to link. So it's just my application. If you look in the content location here, you'll see that it's actually just distributed to a single distribution point. And me, in all my wisdom, I will go in here and say, okay, distribute the content to this for this package to this to preferred DPs. And I know I'm a Dane, and this actually doesn't make any sense to me. So ask Brian, you when you are a native English speaking guy, does that actually make sense? And you said something like,
no,
here.
Not really. I'd look it up.
So you looked it up. So it's a check mark. I will check it. Why not? And what happens is,
maybe I did break it.
Well, that would never ever break this part here. So let's just go into my client here. So here I have a client. And this client here is located in my remote office. I'll just go in and look at my application catalog, and in here, because someone published a link to all users, I can actually go in here and start requesting or installing link, even though it might not be available. So when I click install here, now what it will do is maybe it will fold back to my remote distribution point. And when I say maybe, then that's because it's part of the configuration of the package. Maybe it will fail because it's not locally available. And this one here should actually, just a few seconds here, it should fail. What it does when it fails here is that because I enabled the on-content push, there you go. It generates a DMD file, and what I have up here is a link to my distribution manager inbox. So it generated the DMD file. That file contains information about me requesting this specific package here. And if I go into my distribution manager log file, which I have right here, then you will see that it actually begins to process that very same package. So right now, it distributes the package. I'm completely unaware of that. And I just go in and say, why? Suddenly our WAN guys are calling us and say, hey, what are you doing? This DP down in Tokyo, you really shouldn't be doing anything. And I said, I didn't do anything. Trust me. And of course, they never ever trust me, which is good. So that leads to another question. And that is, when I have all these remote distribution points, how do I actually figure out which DPs are servicing the different clients and how much content is actually being pulled down from the clients from that specific DP? We have we have created a neat little solution for that, where we actually are monitoring all the traffic. By the way, is found in the IIS log files. So you need to have a solution that will go in on that specific DP and read and filter out the information that you need. this application here, we will make it available, so you will all have a chance to test it out. But if I go in here and run my report, I already did that. You'll see here that I have two DPs, and I can see the content size. So this one here has been downloading 1.5 gigabyte, and I can go in and have a look at all the raw data. So if I just expand this report, it will tell me who exactly and what specific time actually downloaded it, which is kind of cool. But I can also, if I summarize the data, I can go in and have a better overview. So if I go in on the very same DP here, and actually hit the plus sign, then I can see per package the size of data that we have downloaded. And one thing that is always pretty interesting, and some people are caught by surprise, that is the skip, so your definition updates. So if I look at this one here, you'll see that this DP is member of the Data Center 1 group, and I can see we're downloading 65 bytes. That's perfectly okay. I'm not worried about that. But if I go all the way down to the bottom here, you'll see you have some clients that actually pull down 64 or 65 megabytes. And if you didn't know about that, then you have a remote location with 600 clients, and they're just beating the hell out of your WAN. So you want to know this. You also want to control it. Setting this up, and I still have a few more minutes, is quite easy. So I have a remote distribution point here, and we created two installers. So on your remote distribution point, if you want to get this to work, we have a MSI file that you just need to install, and of course you can create a package for that. So I'll just go ahead and install the agent.
So some kind of log parser?
Exactly. What it will do is it will create a scheduled job. There will be some PowerShell code down there, and then it will upload all that information to your site server where we have a database, and we have some jobs there summarizing the data. So I just need to specify the name of my database. I want to grab... By default, it just looks at the data that you actually processed yesterday. But since I'm setting this up for the first time, I want to grab all the information that I have out there. And that's about it. So, yeah, you need to. So the question is, do we actually need the IIS locking enabled? Yeah, we require the log file. So, but we only require the log file from yesterday. But we are actually looking at that. So what this one will do is it will just create a scheduled job, and from there on I actually don't have to do much except going in and reading the reports and do my stuff. So you don't want to see an installation going on.
Okay, let me quick get on sub list. I'm going to jump over this kind of quick because we're running out of time. But... I just want to know, you understand there's MP list, and clients will sit there and shuffle around and use one MP or another. If they're all equally weighted, it'll just sit there and pop around. SUPs don't do the same thing. If you make more than one SUP, that next SUP is also made active. Not like any other time up until SP1, this is the first time they've done it. The next SUP becomes active too. So in advance, you want to kind of set up, if you're going to set up lots of SUPs, set them up all in advance. Then turn on software updates to your clients. They'll randomly pick one of those SUPs, and then they will stick to it forever. They don't shuffle around, and they don't do that because there's a certain cost of scan changes involved with them. So, that's wrong. That someone challenged me on that yesterday. That's 4,500K. I should not give anybody a heart attack. But per client, that's still a big number. It's unthrottled, and it can just happen by accident. So if you have a SUP that goes down for 4 hours, a client will sit there and try once for 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 30 minutes, 30 minutes. The last time, it's like, all right, I've given up. I need to scan. I'm not getting an answer from this guy. I'm going to switch to someone else. But when he does that, if you have SQL local on that SUP, that's a brand new scan to that client, and he's going to eat up some of your bandwidth. And if that's not a concern, that's a great way to go anyway. If you don't care about the bandwidth and if that's not a problem, now you still have great redundancy. It means any kind of SUP can go up and down. It means clients are still going to scan and patch. But if it is a concern, Microsoft recommends you offload SQL to another database. So when you set up that SUP, you say, I want to use database on this other server. And as the next SUP, I do the same thing. And so all my SUPs, I'm saying, go use that server for SQL. If SQL is not on the primary, I put it up on a different box. The problem with that is that that box is a single point of failure again. And it's, we're not excited about putting in single points of failure. But experience, I can tell you this, that's exactly what we've been doing with CML7. I have three SUPs per primary, one SUP DB. It's never gone down. It's never given us a problem. But there is a little difference here. In the past, if that SUP DB did go down for any amount of time, I didn't care. Now I do, because I could get a big network hit. So watch that. Read that blog post there to get detailed info on this.
We actually talked to a company not that long ago where they had seen, I think it was 80 or 90 megabytes that they were actually downloading when they switched from one SUP to another SUP. I haven't been able to reproduce that same amount of traffic, but that was what they told us. Yeah. So we still have a few more minutes left. Forest and workgroup support. First of all, installing a client in a workgroup is fully supported. You can do it manually. I have a pretty good friend, Andreas Falk, who has published a run book where he has automated the entire process. So he went to a customer and they have a huge workgroup environment and he needed to install the Config Manager client on several hundred machines. So what he's doing in there is he's actually reading information from a text file and then he's basically just checking all the requirements okay. If they're okay, he will go on, add all the needed information to the host file. He will add the needed information to registry. Then he will install the needed certificates because he's in a PKI environment. Once he has done that, download the Config Manager client locally and then run a local install. And that's not even all. He will actually do a cleanup job, so he will delete everything once he's done. So we have a link to this runbook, and it actually works pretty well. And it's also documented. He documented that in a blog post. So for Forest support, the challenge here is that we don't want to have multiple sites. It's not like in CMO7 where we want to set up a child site in a remote forest. You need to have your primary site in one domain, and then you can service clients in other forests. It works. Okay? You don't have to be a trust between them. You need to open up certain ports in your firewall, and I've been testing the TechNet documents, and they're almost correct. There is a few other additional ports like Kerberos that you need to open also if you're doing system discovery and so on. And then the new thing is we can actually extend the schema in that remote forest. I would usually do that. For me, that does not pose any security issues at all. And what it gives me is that I can publish information about my management point in that remote forest. It just makes my life easier. And it could be without a trust. It doesn't really matter.
When there's no trust, how does that work with network access account?
Oh, so the network access account, we can have only one. You can place remote site systems in the remote forest, but if you set up a distribution point in that remote forest and there is no trust between, that could actually be an issue because your clients won't be able to access any content. We figured out a way to workaround for that. We blocked that workaround I think half a year ago, where you can actually, instead of using a network access account, you can just specify a variable and then make sure that the account that you have on your distribution point is the same. So just make sure you have a local account with the same password and everything, and then it actually works. I think we will skip the demo here in respect of time. And then go to questions. We have like a few more minutes left. So links and everything to the stuff that we have mentioned in here, it's found on the slide deck. We will later today, tonight, we will write a blog post where we will have some links to the, especially to the tool that I demonstrated, a link to the guide that Brian used when he built his replication is already found in here. And with that, thank you all for coming. We will have time to questions. And remember,
you're going to run off quickly.
I will be here for like 5 minutes because I have a session in 25 minutes. But Brian, he will be here, so you can just pick on Brian. But please, any questions? And we actually have some swag for good questions here. And thanks for coming, guys.